On the Wintrust Business Lunch, we're talking to Brian Battle, an advisor at Performance Trust Asset Management. Brian, welcome back. We appreciate your time today. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, John. Thanks for having me.
Let's cut to the chase. What's going to happen Wednesday?
So the Federal Reserve has a two-day meeting. They're talking today. The announcement's tomorrow afternoon. Market expectation is they're going to raise the short-term rate a quarter of a point, so 0.25%. So that is probably the market's betting that's going to happen. The Fed is signaling that's going to happen because their concern, their job, their mandate is to have a stable value of the currency and full employment. So the stuff that's happening short term or stresses in different parts of the country are not their concern specifically. And so I believe they'll hold the course. They won't go a full 50 basis points or 1%, but they'll go a quarter point to prove that they are on the job because they're really concerned about inflation.
Yeah, but are you telling me that what's happening with the banks is not a concern of theirs? Because the interest rate situation is exactly what precipitated what happened at SVB. They're not taking that into consideration?
So I think let's be a little bit clear about what happened at SVB. So, and let's make a little comparison to history. So in 2008, the last time there was a financial crisis, that was about the solvency of the banks and lending institutions. They lent a bunch of money and the loans went bad. Now in 2023, what we have is a liquidity crisis, which is a lack of confidence, meaning your depositors leave. And this is exactly what happened at SVB. It was a high-tech bank. There was a lot of high-tech businesses with a lot of cash on deposit. So you and I, we have a deposit on our $250,000. We're insured. But a lot of businesses have deposits or checking accounts or operating accounts where their balances are over $250,000. And at SVB, like 90% of their deposits were business accounts over $250,000. And when those high-tech companies felt like things weren't going well, they all left together. So SVB had a highly, highly correlated customer set that left. That is known, if you watch It's a Wonderful Life, it's a run on the bank. People took all their deposits out. So that is a unique thing to SVB. It's happened to a bank in New York, another bank in San Francisco, but there's 5,000 banks in the U.S., thousands of credit unions that aren't having this experience. So it's a big headline. It's a big deal. There's a policy implications. But what does it mean for the broader economy? Not much, because so far this year, the S&P is up 3.7%. And the financials are a smaller part of the economy than industrial or consumer or information technology. So, no, I think the Federal Reserve is going to raise rates because what happened at SVB is idiosyncratic. It's not endemic. And, you know, if you talk to banks around the country, you know, Wintrust, you know, down the street there, the sponsor of this fine show, there's no run at Wintrust. So people have confidence in the banking system. It's just some regional banks are having trouble.
I appreciate you reminding us that the S&P is up 3.7%. But just to go back to the role that maybe the Fed and interest rates played, it was sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy at Silicon Valley Bank, it seems to me, because realizing that those 10-year notes were going to be undervalued, people thought, well, if people withdraw their money, they're not going to have the assets. If they sell them, they'll have to sell them at a discount. I'd better get mine now. But if they hadn't done that, we wouldn't be here. And all of that, if you will, was a function of interest rates on the 10-year and the 2-year.
Yes, absolutely. So banks borrow money short, so they take in your deposit and they invest it. They can buy bonds or they can make loans. And Silicon Valley Bank, at the absolutely lower rates in 20 and 2021, bought a bucket load of bonds with really, really low yields. So you're correct. But that is a function of certainly interest rates go up, and all banks know that rates can go up or go down. They understand that they have that risk of interest rates going up and down, and SVB didn't manage it maybe as appropriately they could have. And you're right, they got caught, because when people asked for their cash back, when the depositors wanted all their deposits back, they couldn't sell their bonds because there were such great losses. So that required an unbelievable, unusual activity by the Federal Reserve to guarantee all deposits at the bank. So this is the unusual and exigent circumstance clause where they guaranteed all the deposits, even deposits over the $250,000 limit.
That was the right call, Brian?
Confidence.
Was that the right call? And will they do that again in the future?
Yeah, so they that is a great policy question. Should they or shouldn't they? You have to be careful what you wish for, because if the Federal Reserve guarantees all deposits, what they're going to do is magnify risk in the banking system, because if all deposits are guaranteed, then banks don't have interest rate risk. So interest rate risk fosters discipline. So if you run your bank with discipline, you shouldn't be in the situation that they were in. But that's a really big question. And do you ask it appropriately? Because the Federal Reserve, Janet Yellen, is talking about that. Like, maybe we should insure all deposits. That would be bad news, I think, for consumers, because what's going to happen right now for sure is you and I and everybody else, our cost of banking is going to go up because we all have to pay the loss that SVB took.
I get you on that. Brian Battle, advisor, Performance Trust Asset Management. PerformanceTrust.com is the website for Brian. Nice to talk to you, Brian. Thanks for your thoughts today.
You're welcome, John.
Kerry Pinkowski joins us now. Happy St. Patrick's Month, Kerry.
John, how are you? It's nice to talk to you this afternoon.
You're the executive race director, we know, for the Chicago Marathon, but also the Shamrock Shuffle, and that's coming up this weekend, right?
This Sunday, yes, the 42nd running of this great Chicago tradition. As you mentioned, the end of the St. Patrick's Day celebration. But we're so happy, very humbled by the support and demand this year, and we're back at full strength and looking forward to a great day this Sunday.
Why do you say support and demand? What have you got?
We have sold out. We have 26,000 runners signed up for Sunday. We'll have over 2,000 walkers. And our mile on Saturday afternoon, we've got about 500 people running in the mile, some elite, some first-time runners. So we've got quite a schedule going.
But the shuffle is just a couple miles, right?
It's 8K, a little bit short of 5 miles. It's a great tour of the loop. You get to see some great architecture, just experience the loop starting and finishing in Grant Park. I am actually running this year. This is the fourth year in a row that I have I'm participating. And I have decided to, in the past couple of years to support local charity. So I'm raising some money. I'm excited about it. I have a lot of fun. I mean, I work in the loop. I walk up and down Washington. I walk down Wacker all the time. But it just seems a little bit different and a little bit more energy on Shamrock Sunday.
It's a 2 mile walk and then the 8K run through downtown. So I can watch, but I can't be a legal runner. Is that right?
Yeah, we're obviously the event is closed, but I was talking to Pete Zimmerman. He's running, so you have some representation there. But if you want to come down, our website, shamrockshuffle.com, has all the information if you want to come down and cheer or come to our post-race party on Buckingham Fountain. Looking forward to a great day.
People use this event not just to get out and run, but also to raise money. Tell me a little bit about some of the charities and the dollars.
Yeah, I mean, you know what? It's a wonderful tool. Obviously, you mentioned the marathon in the fall, but it's a great tool for us if we have a new wrinkle in technology or we're using something a little bit different that we may introduce in the marathon to try it out. It's a great vehicle for me to also, and for our organization, we have our Deloitte Elite competition. So we have some athletes that are running in the team competition. We start and finish where the marathon finishes and use the same hotel, so they get a real kind of flavor of how we stage the marathon. So there's a couple of athletes that we'll see that I'll probably approach about coming back in the fall. It's a great opportunity for our charity program, which goes all through the summer through our 13.1 and then into the fall. Our charity partners have an opportunity to engage with their runners and also to recruit some runners. So it's just a great enthusiastic kickoff to the running season and an amazing rite of spring.
I suppose you know, but it's nice because you've got the Shamrock Shuffle, you've got the half marathon, you've got the marathon in the fall, and more than just events for the community. These are sort of, signposts for people. A lot of people are very busy doing a lot of things because these events take place.
Sure. I mean, obviously, no one can argue that getting moving, running, or walking like we'll see this weekend, but people who discover running, I mean, I think the ultimate expression is experience the marathon or aspiring to be part of the marathon. We have, obviously, the Bank of America Chicago Marathon, which is part of the Abbott World Marathon Majors here in Chicago, world-class event. So it's an opportunity for people from the community to experience and be part of that event. We always engage with our charity partners, so there's access through that, but It's a great, what better way to see the city of Chicago block by block, neighborhood by neighborhood. Great tour of the city and the Shamrock Shuffle Ball, also in the fall and the marathon. So, we're looking forward to a great year this year. We'll be back full strength, obviously, with with the shuffle through the 13.1, and then at the marathon, we'll be back with 45,000 runners
wow.
in the fall. So
wow, what fun.
And, John, there's three pillars to this. I mean, there's the social. Obviously, people are out running. There's the business side of it, the economic driver to the community, and then the philanthropic side. So it's something I've been fortunate enough to be involved with, the events. This is for quite a while now, and it still amazes me, the energy and the enthusiasm.
It gets people in the loop, too. I'm happy for anything that does that. How many folks do you imagine? You said 20,000-plus runners. How many folks will be downtown to watch?
We'll probably have I'm probably going to say about 35,000 people will make their way downtown on Sunday. They get out along the course, and then they get through the finish line. They reconnect with their family, friends, significant others, and then they make their way. They have brunch. They spend some time in the Loop River North. So it really does bring some energy to the Loop on a Sunday morning.
Hey, what's the website for you? You're about $19,000 shy of your goal of 100K. Let's put some money in the pocket that you're trying to raise for. Where do we go?
Yeah, if you go to our website, shamrockshuffle.com, it'll connect you to what I'm doing. I'm running for Students Run Chicago this year, which is a great organization that works with youth in the Chicago area and introduces running as kind of the platform in which they connect. They do tutoring and mentoring, and they've had great success. Mm-hmm. I've been working with Marco Galvin there. I'm a little over 91,000 for the last 4 years, so I'm clawing my way to the 100,000 mark, but you know, it's just such a wonderful integration of the activity and the philanthropic and the fundraising side of it. And we've got a great suite of sponsors that help us out with that. So we do some good work. So I'll be out there. I'm not going to say I'm going to go real fast, but I'm going to be out there on Sunday.
Bet you'll do pretty well. ShamrockShuffle.com. Carrie Pinkowski. Okay, we'll talk a few more times this year as we follow the running season. But good luck and thanks, Carrie.
John, thank you very much.
Boy, between the mayor's race, the NCAA tournament, the bank failures, we haven't spent much time talking about the nuts and bolts of your taxes. Mark Stieber is the Senior Vice President and Chief Tax Information Officer at Jackson Hewitt. Let's talk about some of the things people should be thinking about and doing. Mark, welcome back to the show. How are you today?
I'm doing wonderful. Very exciting time here as we get to the final days of tax season. It's not really when now. It's what's your plan?
That's not the sort of enthusiasm I thought you'd have. That's really nice. It's I have a friend who's an accountant, and, you know, he called me on Sunday, and I said, oh, man, you're working every hour of every day now. But you're right. Here comes April 18th, right?
Do have a few extra days this year, the 15th on the weekend, and Monday's Emancipation Day in the District of Columbia, so they close the IRS. But that very small amount of, what I'll call insurance time, once you get down to those couple of days, you really have waited really, really to the end. So you've still got a month left or so. Probably a good idea this weekend or as soon as you can to get after it, because you don't want to be caught in that surge. You know, I think the IRS put out some data last Friday that said about 60 million people have filed so far. Refunds are a little lower, but that leaves about 100 million ready to go. And with 30 or so days left, there will be a tremendous push at the end on preparers, on software, on computers, on the IRS access. You don't want to be in that group, I promise you.
Give me some just ballpark things people should be aware of this year.
Well, it's a much more complicated tax year this year than in prior years. So if you're planning to just do cookie cutter, look at last year's, a lot of things changed. The credits for child care and dependent care went way back down to pre-pandemic amounts. There's no longer a charitable donation unless you itemize. That went away. There's no stimulus to add onto your tax return this year because that was a 2021 issue. And then on top of that, you still have life changes, which are frankly bigger than tax changes. People are still getting married. They're still buying homes, going back to college. They're raising children. They're getting divorced. You know, all of those have a huge impact, and that won't even touch the self-employed side giggers or people trading in virtual currency, you know, and those kind of things. It can also add a level of complexity to your tax return. So it's not just business as usual. Look at last year's and do it on the phone on your way into work. If you do that, you're just courting a mistake, and the mistake's not an IRS audit. It's really you'll leave something off. You'll leave off a benefit. You'll leave off a credit. And here's something for your listeners. If you leave off a benefit, the IRS is not in the correction business to make sure you get more money. You leave it off, it stays off. So it's in your best interest to pay attention to your largest single financial transaction, namely your tax return, each and every year. And now's the time.
What happened to accounting for Zelle and Venmo, when we transfer money and if it exceeds an amount. We were very agitated about that last year and the year before. This is the year that's supposed to be in place, right?
Well, it was. For your listeners, typically if you transfer money through an electronic platform, Apple Pay, Zelle, Venmo, if you have more than 200 transactions and $20,000 in activity, the rule is the IRS gets a notice, you get a notice, you get a 1099-K, summarizing it all. Well, they changed that rule about 2 years ago, starting for this year, or starting for actually tax year 2022. If you did more than one transaction or more, and $600, then you get the 1099-K summarizing your activity. Well, that was pretty big lift, really placed into service at the last minute. And so at the last hour in December 2022, they pushed that rule for one more year. Well, they pushed it to this year, actually. So starting on January 1st, 2023, as the rule is currently in place, if you have more than $600, you're going to get a 1099-K next January for your tax return consideration. So if you've got a side gig and you've got self-employment activity and you're getting paid through Venmo or one of those, you're going to get a statement next year, and you'll have to make sure you reconcile that on your tax return, you know, and show what that means. Doesn't mean that's all that's taxable, but that is the gross revenue that one company has tracked for you, and then you have to add your expenses and other deductions and so forth to calculate that for your tax return, unless it's a mistake, which is another whole bag of issues.
Yeah, right. But maybe we'll spend more time on this next year, but the concern was that a lot of those Venmo transactions are not business transactions. They're not income. They're just transferring money for rent or transferring money at the restaurant and should not be taxed. So we're going to have this conversation down the road, right?
Well, we're going to have this conversation down the road, but that's why they delayed it 1 year, so they could put out more guidance, so they could let the companies know how to do it better and more accurately allow people. But we're in that mode right now. That's a 2023 calculation rule. So starting in January 2024, those statements are supposed to go out unless there's a change, unless there's another modification,
right,
which could very well happen. But I guess the point is, if you're getting money right now, you need to keep good records because you may get a statement next January for next year's taxes.
Well, that's it. And I don't know anybody that's doing that. But if I Venmo somebody some money or they Venmo me, one of us needs to have some ledger somewhere and say, this $100 was them picking up the check at the restaurant, or my son contributes to the rent in the condo. He gives us $600 every month. So that's not income. That's just him subsidizing or me subsidizing the rent, right? That's not taxable, is it?
Exactly. And that's where the catch-22 is. There is a business element out there. Some of this false dolphins in the net catching is going to get into a lot of trouble. And they're supposed to be perfecting that. There's supposed to be agreements. You're supposed to check a box on some of the platforms that this is personal. You know, some of them say they have artificial intelligence on the description, you know, but a lot of that's work in process. So we do anticipate there are going to be some mistakes unless they raise the threshold or some other things that are being talked about. But for right now, it's one in 600. We'll see how it ends up at the end of the year once the really discussion starts to take place.
Mark Stieber's on a line from Jackson Hewitt. I think it was on David Hackberg's show on Saturday. He has an accountant there frequently. And somebody asked about making, maybe it was Lisa's show, but one of our listeners said, I just throw money in the basket at church every Sunday. And over the course of a year, it's $500, $600. Is that deductible? I thought that those sorts of contributions were not deductible anymore. What can you tell us about that?
Well, the rule's a good rule. You are able to take cash and fair market value of property donated to a charity. That's still the rule, always is the rule. Now, you're supposed to have what the IRS defines as contemporaneous documentation of your, you know, tax deductions or any deduction on your tax return. What that ends up being really depends on the facts and circumstances. Best case is a canceled check. Worst case is a handwritten note at the tax time that, oh, yeah, I gave $500. Upon audit, you'll have to just trust in the mercy of the IRS to allow that or not allow that. And it'll be dependent on, again, the preponderance of activity on the tax return. If you got a $10,000 deduction, mm-hmm. if you gave $1,000, you know, every 2 weeks, I suspect the IRS is going to take a blind
okay.
look at that and say no. But
yeah,
it really depends on your search. More documents are better. That's the way I'll leave it.
Mostly people are using the standardized deduction, right? So
90%, yes.
So really, unless you have high income or high contributions to charities, you're going to be below the threshold. This doesn't matter. Is that true?
That is absolutely true. Most Americans either get the $12,000 standard deduction for singles, about 18 if you've got a head of household and a dependent or single, or 24 or 5,000 if you're married. You have to have more than that in mortgage interest, property taxes, sales taxes, income taxes at the state level, charitable donations, and medical. If you got more than that all added up, then you're an itemized deduction taker. Less than that, it really doesn't matter what you donate. You don't get a deduction, which is a little bit different than last year, back to one of those rule changes. Last year, you could take a small charitable donation, didn't have to itemize. That expired December 31st, 2021. So 2022, you didn't get that. Mm-hmm.
Mark Stieber knows his stuff, Senior Vice President and Chief Tax Information Officer at Jackson Hewitt, jacksonhewitt.com. Mark, I'll call you again. Thanks for your help today.
All right, y'all have a great time. 30-odd days. Go get your money. It's not going to be automatic.
Business news continues now with Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Some Chicago area banks want all bank deposits nationwide to be fully insured for the next 2 years. The current coverage applies only to a maximum of $250,000 per bank per depositor. A national coalition that represents mid-sized banks, including Wintrust and Byline, have petitioned federal banking regulators and the Treasury Department to make the change. The move comes after the collapse of California's Silicon Valley Bank and New York's Signature Bank. The coalition says the move would help shore up confidence in the banking system. Only depositors would be covered, not investors. Rush University System for Health is planning a new outpatient center that would cover part of Chicago and the suburbs. It would be built on the site of the old Sears store at North in Harlem in the city's Galewood neighborhood. The $70 million, 60,000 square foot outpatient center will offer cancer, cardiology, and neurology services. The facility would include 90 examination, consultation, and procedure rooms, plus lab and radiology services. The facility would include 200 parking spaces. The center is slated to open in early 2025. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
We've got the business of food and Steve Alexander.
Yep, and we're sponsored on this very important day by the Chevy Silverado HD. Experience your life in HD. Visit ChevyDriveChicago.com. The very important day? Hey, it's National Agriculture Day. And here's Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack with a few words about the men and women who till the soil and put food on our tables.
Rural America is the backbone of this country, and on this National Ag Day, we must take time to thank them for their passionate work to provide our country and the world with its food, fuel, and fiber. So on this 50th annual National Ag Day, let us all take a moment to recognize and be thankful for the contributions that those who work the land make for all of us and for our great country. We are certainly a better nation for the work they do.
Yes, we are, and there's no doubt, in my mind at least, that agriculture is our most essential industry. The food, the fiber, and the fuel that Mr. Vilsack mentioned. Or, put another way, without agriculture, you'd be hungry, homeless, naked, and sober. So, I think it's safe to suggest that if you see a farmer today, go ahead and give him or her a hug of appreciation. With permission, of course. Okay, let's move on to eggs. And I know a lot of us are doing the backyard chicken thing, or in Mr. Surratt's case, the radio studio chicken thing. But egg prices have been coming down, and last month...
eggs went down 6.7%.
That is USDA economist Matt McLaughlin, and I think we should go ahead and take the win, but prices are still...
55.4% above February 2022 numbers.
Hey, one of the drivers of the higher prices has been bird flu, which has resulted in over 50 million birds being destroyed. There is a little bit of good news there.
We haven't had a case of avian influenza in an egg-laying operation since December. That's not to say that we won't have those going forward, but for both January and February, at least we did not have egg layers that were, commercial egg layers at least, that were impacted by avian influenza.
Matt McLaughlin of the USDA, and from the farm to your belly, today's National French Bread Day. It's also National Crunchy Taco Tuesday, and once again, Happy Agriculture Day. That's the business of food on 720 WGN.
Let's talk a little bit about real estate with Laura Ellis, Chief Strategy Officer and president of residential sales at Baird and Warner. This, I guess, is the time of year when folks think real estate because we're post-Oscars and post-Super Bowl. Is that sort of date on the calendar still hold up, Laura?
Yeah. Hi, John. Thanks for having me on. And yes, I absolutely agree with that. We're just now entering really the next 3 months. That'll be the height of our spring market.
But you said that the biggest issue isn't interest rates, it's something else relative to transactions this spring. What is it?
What it is, John, is a lack of listing inventory. We just simply don't have enough homes to sell.
So does that mean if I am trying to sell my home, leery though some people may be because they're in the market but interest rates are high, they got nowhere else to go. Are there a lot of cash buyers out there? Do people not worry so much about interest because they've got money?
Well, what we've experienced over the last couple of years is a higher percentage of our transactions are, in fact, cash than we've ever had historically before. That being said, in the Midwest, in the Chicago area, the majority of our transactions are financed. But there has been this growing trend of more cash transactions.
I like this piece of advice you passed along to us. Date the rate, marry the house. You can always refinance. Date the rate, marry the house. Meaning you may not like that rate, but if you like that house, go ahead and get it, huh?
Yeah, that's what we really recommend people do. You know, it's virtually impossible to time the market. And if you just look at the real estate market over the last couple of years, it rarely has turned out as we thought it would at the beginning of the year. And so, you know, real estate is driven by people's lives. And so we really encourage people to do what's in their best interest right now based on their individual circumstances, regardless of the rate. They can always refinance later.
And when rates were lower, you had bidding wars. People were asking a price, and the first offers were list plus. So maybe at least now, while you might not like borrowing money at 6 or 7%, you don't have 10 other people putting $50,000 on top of the price.
That is true. So you're definitely better off today as a buyer. However, there's a caveat there, and that is because of the lack of available properties for sale, we're still seeing multiple offers.
So what? Talk to me about prices then. What are people getting? Are they up, they down? Where are we right now in Chicago?
In the median price points in each one of our marketplaces, and you know, the Chicagoland market's pretty vast, sellers are getting close to and over asking price.
No kidding.
It is moderating compared to what it was last year, though.
This is residential we're talking about. Are you involved in the business side, too? Are you in the loop? Are you in the suburbs with office buildings, that sort of thing?
We're primarily a residential company. We do a little bit of commercial, but it's light commercial. And depending on where our agents are in the field and where their specialties are, but overwhelmingly, we're residential.
But just along those lines, Lev, maybe a last question for you today, and that is, do you find, though, that the exodus from the city is still taking place and people are moving to the suburbs or the exurbs, or has that moderated? Is that no longer a big factor?
It's a great question, John, and I believe it's moderating. Now, that is my opinion. Some others may disagree with that, but overall, you know, Chicago's a resilient city. It's a fantastic place to live. And we still have plenty of buyer demand for people moving into the city. As many that are moving out, we have just as many moving in right now. So it has moderated. Yeah.
Laura Ellis says, date the rate, marry the house. You can always refi. She's the Chief Strategy Officer and President of Residential Sales at Baird & Warner. Nice to talk to you, Laura. Let's talk again later this spring.
Sounds great. Thanks so much, John.